Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Linda Spinney and Amar Khan, from Trailblazers Tandem. So, can you tell me a little bit about Trailblazers Tandem?
Yes. Trailblazers is a community-based or recreational club with a twist. We provide recreational cycling for those who have limited or no vision to cycle with sighted volunteers on club-owned tandems.
Do you find there are any myths in society about whether a person with a vision impairment would actually be able to get out there and cycle?
Certainly. I mean, even myths aside, even people who are blind or partially sighted a lot of the time don't know if they can cycle or have the ability to cycle still after their vision loss. Some people are born with vision loss, but other people have vision loss later on in life. So when that happens, you know, there's certain uncertainty about what you can or can't do. So Trailblazers is really a way for people to rediscover that piece of themselves that you can cycle safely with sighted volunteers.
So how do you go about training a person with newly acquired vision impairment to get on there and to operate the device safely?
First, we advertise. That once you know how to cycle, we can teach you. You don't have to know how to ride a tandem, and we also provide training videos to help them along. And any new or past member who came back to the club will always do an orientation. Everyone has to do one before joining the club.
So, do you use modified tandems, or is it just a regulation model?
So, we use standard tandem cycles. There's a couple of things in terms of equipment that we look for when we're purchasing tandems for the club. We obviously want to cater to, you know, general size specifications and durability specifications for our members. But we also want to make sure that the type of tandem that we use is the kind that allows both people to pedal. So there are tandem cycles out there where, you know, one person can stop pedaling and the other person can continue pedaling. Since we are a tandem cycling club and we, you know, encourage that team aspect, we do look for the tandems where both folks have to pedal.
So I'd love to hear about the volunteers. What types of people come in and make the cycling possible?
Most of our volunteers are cyclists themselves and find that this is right up their alley for volunteering. We get most of our volunteers through Volunteer Toronto and through a trade show here in Toronto called the International Toronto Bicycle Show. A lot of our volunteers come from there.
So, are there any challenges in putting together a cycling program for those with vision impairments?
Not necessarily for people with vision loss or people who are blind or partially sighted, but putting together a bicycling program in general is a lot of work. As Linda indicated, we've been a cycling club since 1986. So we've grown in size and scope since that time, and you know, just the general operations that we have group rides once a month, typically in a normal cycling year. We have obviously maintenance, things that we need to do on our bicycles, volunteers to team up, volunteers to find, and you know, events that we do throughout the year. Orientation is something that Linda mentioned, and that's probably where the scope of the blind, sighted, partially sighted aspect of the members come into play, in terms of you know getting people comfortable with riding a tandem and going through those instructional pieces to help people really get comfortable with a tandem. I think one of the most common misconceptions of people in general about tandem cycling is that you can get two people and just get on a tandem and you'll figure it out fairly quickly. And you know, lots of people have done this on vacation who are sighted or not sighted and have you know different kinds of results. And that's something that we try to avoid in terms of streamlining the process to help people be as successful as possible in terms of riding a tandem cycle. So pairing people up who are experienced volunteers with brand new blind or partially sighted stokers, the person on the back of the bike, or the reverse, where you know, we have an experienced stoker with a brand new captain, and you know, doing that hand-holding and that training to really let people get the most out of the cycling experience.
The other thing that's important in an orientation is weight and height. We have to match the captain and the stoker according to weight. We cannot put a stoker who weighs 200 pounds with a captain who only weighs 145 pounds. It really throws the balance off on a tandem. I even had a couple almost, well, put it this way, they had quite a serious discussion over it and could have ended up in divorce almost, per se. But I had a couple call me from Wales and had asked us questions about it. They saw us on the internet and said, you know, we have a few questions. We're not enjoying our tandem as much as we thought we could. So, of course, we helped them with a few tips on what a stoker's supposed to do and what a captain's supposed to do.
So, in your time with Trailblazers, is there any success story that stands out for you?
Yes. I mean, one of the things that really defines our success is the number of sheds that we have throughout the city. Anytime we actually open a new shed, it's always a moment of triumph for us. It's always really good to see us being able to do that. In the GTA, we have a few sheds around town, and it really helps people who in different areas who may have trouble getting to the sheds that we currently have to be able to cycle and you know share in that experience. You know, not too long ago, we added one in the Kennedy Station area in Scarborough, which allowed a lot of our East End club members to have access to that area and for the captains to be able to go out there too. So, you know, it's always a great sort of time in the year and always a great time for us when we were able to open a new shed for the club.
When opening up a shed, there's a few details that have to be looked at before opening up one. The safety of our members, of course, is the most important part. And the other part is our partnerships with the different organizations like Parks, Forestry, and Recreation. They're our biggest supporter. They've supplied us with 3 sheds across the city. And, of course, CNIB, we have one in their building. And transportation is a key factor as well.
So I'm guessing as a rider gets more and more comfortable, more and more experienced, the trails might increase in difficulty?
Yes. In general, distance is the factor. In you know, southern Ontario, in the GTA, the ground is fairly flat, so the routes don't challenge too much in terms of terrain, but you know, the way we typically put our calendar together in terms of group rides for a typical year, the rides get longer. We typically tend to stick to bike routes in and around the GTA for the most part, but in general, the distances get longer as the year progresses.
So, how can people go about finding out more information about your work?
They can go to our website, trailblazerstandem.org, or they can call us at 647-849-5900. That is our voicemail. They can leave a message, and we call them back within 48 hours. Very in tune to the COVID-19 pandemic, the club takes that very serious. And we have in place a waiver for each member and captain must sign before they go out on each ride. We also have them check out the Ministry of Health website and fill out their questionnaire, and then they sign our waiver in return, saying that they read it and did answer the questions and that they're safe. And then we also have a PPE kit in each shed where they have to clean the bikes with Lysol cleaner or wipes. We have wipes as well as gloves and masks. They have to wear a mask when they're in a public area, but when cycling, they can lower it a little bit because it is difficult to breathe when cycling with a mask.
I know Linda wanted to mention the makeup of our club. We are an inclusive and diverse group of people, and it's something that I wanted to mention because it is something sort of unique to our club that, we have people in the club from all sorts of age groups, all sorts of races, but, we come together to cycle, and we really have a great time doing it.
I'd like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, Dave Wilsey will be telling us a little bit about his experiences with wheelchair rugby. So tell me a bit about your experiences with wheelchair rugby.
I became paralyzed back in 1995 in London, Ontario. And from playing ice hockey, I went headfirst in the boards. So during my rehab, I met a couple guys that played wheelchair rugby for the London team. And it sounded like a pretty cool sport. A lot of the same aspects as hockey. It's fast, hard-hitting. And I love my team sports, so I got involved in there.
So, in terms of your recovery from becoming paralyzed, can you tell me a bit about how the sport helped you mental health-wise?
Yeah, big time. The beautiful part about sport is it helps you with those areas without you even knowing it. So I think the first big thing is I'm playing on team sport with other guys with my very similar disability. So you don't have that feeling of being all alone. You learn from them their day-to-day lives, tricks of the trade, and how to get around things. I learned how to travel and everything from these guys, and I think the most important thing though is I was competing again. I kind of got my swag back.
So what sort of modified equipment do you use in the sport?
Yeah, so I play wheelchair rugby, and its nickname is Murder Ball, and it is a full contact sport, so we use a wheelchair, but they're heavily reinforced and they have smash rails all around them, so even called Mad Max or that sort of idea.
So I'm guessing it plays with similar rules to the able-bodied version.
Actually, no, it doesn't. It was actually a sport invented in Canada all on its own with its own set of rules and everything. And then and it was called Murder Ball for the first 10 years. It kind of looks like basketball. We play on a basketball court. We inbound like basketball. But instead of trying to shoot the hoop at the end of the court, we have to carry it across the goal line. And because it's full contact, those are the similarities with rugby. But that's about where the similarities end.
So, can you tell me a bit about some of the training that goes into you and your teammates? some of how you prepare yourselves physically for
A couple of the big changes over the years have been the turning into full-time athletes and full-time coaches, which not only physically makes a better athlete, but also the amount of hours in film session and mental imagery and sports psych and all the different aspects of that. So aside from COVID, our guys will be, you know, three weight sessions a week, two track sessions, and then probably three on-court sessions. And that's just the physical side of it, not to mention the hours of film they're watching.
So, in terms of COVID, how has the team kept up their skill?
Well, we had to be creative. We have guys on our team from Vancouver Island all the way to Quebec City and all parts in between, so we're pretty spread out. And usually they're playing a lot of club rugby, but obviously they're not now. So they're still working out and lifting the weights. So that's not an issue. But finding a suitable track time and on-court time is difficult. And some guys are being creative and finding an empty parking garage or whatever it is to do different things. So no two plans are the same, that's for sure.
So, in your time with the sport, is there any success moment that stands out for you?
Definitely. You know, aside from, well, three Paralympic medals with the Team Canada is a highlight. Winning the World Championship gold in 2002 against a powerhouse from the U.S. Really showed how our team sticks together, and we really do have a unique identity in Canada as having each other's backs and you know, the older guys helping the younger guys eventually take their spot on the team, but not that no hesitation doing that.
So, do you find there's enough recognition of parasport out there?
Well, yes and no. I started. My first Paralympics was in 2000 in Sydney, Australia, and I, to be honest, I didn't know a lot about the Paralympics before that either. So, and there wasn't a big hub about it. Over the years, it's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's actually, I think, getting quite massive. However, I feel bad because a lot of people still don't know about it. So. It's one of those things that's growing and it's going in the right direction, but, you know, sky's the limit.
So, if you could send any message out there to all the young athletes who might be wondering if they can get back into sport, if they have what it takes, what would you tell them?
It's there. You might have to do a little research online to find the program that you want, but whatever sport, you know, tickles your fancy, whether it's swimming, tennis, wheelchair rugby, basketball, I mean, sledge, like whatever sport it is, it's available. You just have to find it. And, you know, now all the websites are up and running pretty well so that you can track it down. And the other thing is, just do it to have fun. You're always better at something if you're enjoying it. And then it's a lot easier to put the work in later. But I would aim to be a Paralympian right off the start. I'd aim to just go out and have fun and I think you'll surprise yourself with how quickly you can, you know, excel.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
No problem, Cam. You betcha. Thank you.
Of course. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
CJAM 99.1 FM is looking for musically minded volunteers hungry for the studio experience. Stop by the CAW Student Center at the University of Windsor and give us a visit. With our access to great tech and music as far as the ear can hear, craft your very own radio show or help make it happen behind the scenes. Not a student, not a problem. All you need to qualify are headphones and a hip attitude. More information at cjam.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. An organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about tandem biking from Linda Spinney and Amar Khan, and a little bit about wheelchair rugby from Dave Wilsey. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Tammy Black from the Immune Deficiency Foundation. So, can you tell me a little bit about the foundation?
Sure. The Immune Deficiency Foundation we have been around for about 40 years. We're located in Baltimore, Maryland, and we serve families and patients and providers who have primary immunodeficiencies across the U.S. and even globally.
So, for those who might not be as familiar with the impact of an immunodeficiency, can you tell me a little about that?
Absolutely. Thanks for asking.
Of course.
Primary immunodeficiencies are a group of rare chronic disorders, and what happens is that part of the body's immune system is either missing or it's not functioning properly. There are more than 400 of these diagnoses. We call them PI or PI, but primary immunodeficiencies, and they have a wide variety of symptoms and manifestations that might include recurrent infections, sinus or GI issues, skin conditions. Some of these diagnoses are life-threatening, and they all are the result of a compromised immune system.
So I'm guessing with the past year and the pandemic that those with a compromised immune system might have found themselves more susceptible or at higher risk for COVID.
Absolutely. There is obviously, you know, the research is still out on all of it. One thing that we've noted that seems to be true is that members of the PI community, they were already so aware of protecting their immune compromised status that they have stayed home, they have adjusted their lives sometimes more, and there is, I hate to call it an added benefit in the middle of a pandemic, but there has been one kind of side effect of the pandemic is that people in the general population understand what it means to have a compromised immune system more than they did 15 or 18 months ago, and that has helped us raise awareness for both our condition and, you know, others out there that might have compromised immune systems.
So, how do you reach out to the public about your work?
Yeah, we have a website. It's primaryimmune.org, and we have about 50,000 families that are, we call them members, but parts of our community. We have a walk every year. Before COVID, it was happening in 32 cities across the U.S., but it happened virtually in 2020 and will again in 2021. And that is, we recruit groups of people to go out and raise funds, but also awareness for PI. We have educational forums several times a month online through Zoom that are on a variety of topics that might affect the PI community. And we have our conference, the Primary Immune Deficiency Conference, is coming up in June, and we're expecting a few thousand people to attend. It's going to be amazing. We've had a lot of online virtual events over the last year and a half.
So, are there any challenges for those affected with a PI that you'd like to share?
Yeah, absolutely. For many forms of PI, the recommended treatment is immunoglobulin therapy or IG therapy, and that is created through plasma donation, so it's a biotherapy. And over the last year and a half, because of the pandemic, because of limits on plasma donation centers, there's a real concern that a plasma shortage might be on the way. So that is something that we have been really, really following and cognizant of, and we launched an initiative this past summer called Plasma Hero. It's a new website and initiative to really raise awareness about the importance of plasma donations, but to highlight plasma donors as the life-saving heroes that they are. So there is an interactive map on the website where people can find a plasma donation center in their area. And we tell the stories of plasma heroes from all over that are either donating plasma or kind of raising the flag with their friends and family of how important plasma donation is.
So, in your time with the foundation, what's been the greatest success you've witnessed?
Oh, wow, that's a really good question. I think that, and I will kind of introduce us with, I have been here for less than a year and a half at this point. So I joined the kind of family at IDF in November of 2019. So within just a few months of my working there, we all kind of picked up our laptops and moved home and started running this organization completely virtually, which we're still doing today. And I think that ability to pivot and to still offer the educational programs we were offering in a different way that was safe and accessible, and we really didn't skip a beat, and I'm really proud of that. I'm really proud of the work we do to provide education opportunities to the community and awareness opportunities to people that don't already know about primary immunodeficiencies.
So when you mention educational opportunities, are there any myths out there concerning PIs?
I think one myth is that some people might think that they're contagious, right? Because people that have a PI might have recurring infections or be sick all the time, and it is not a contagious condition, it is a genetic condition. I think that is probably one. I think that some people, it's very difficult to be diagnosed if your physician is not familiar with what might need to be tested for. The average time to diagnosis is 9 to 15 years. So people suffer with all kinds of kind of mystery ailments that don't have an answer until suddenly they learn that what they've got is some form of a primary immunodeficiency. So I think that if there's one kind of myth we definitely want to bust, it's that, you know, there is a diagnosis for it, and that there are treatment options that can make your life very manageable.
So about how many people do you know offhand are affected by these conditions?
Yeah, the estimate based on research that we've done is that it's anticipated that as many as 250,000 Americans have a primary immunodeficiency, but thousands and thousands go undiagnosed every year.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need for accurate diagnosis and ongoing support for those affected, what would you say?
Yeah, I would say that I would have a message for those affected and not, probably. One is that not all disorders are visible, and so don't assume that just because someone looks healthy that they are. I think that is number one. And number two, if you are healthy and want to help out, donate plasma. Look into it, see if you can. You literally are saving a life.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure, absolutely.
My friends, perhaps the greatest danger in disability life is the idea of misdiagnosis. Some conditions do look alike. For a doctor, it's always critical to take the time to understand the exact situation. There's no value in an incorrect diagnosis and incorrect treatment. In fact, it may make matters worse. A patient has every right to say, "This is how I feel, these are the symptoms, this is what I've tried, this is what's worked, this is what hasn't." Fact is, it is incumbent upon the patient to know their own situation. But also, for those doctors who may have one day or one paragraph on a rare condition, it doesn't mean that's the end of it. It doesn't mean they're never going to encounter it. It simply means taking time, taking care, to find out what the real situation is. With knowledge, with a firm foundation of any given condition, you can start to work from a set of circumstances. However, medical science can't factor in human strength. It cannot factor in those who have done the impossible, whose determination and courage have allowed them to do things we would consider, if not extremely unlikely, then downright impossible. Those people have survived the insurmountable. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.